history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we come out way ahead because we're educated, we're entertained, and so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 75 years ago this week, the world first experienced the horrifying power of nuclear weapons when first Hiroshima and then Nagasaki bore the brunt of atomic bombs dropped by B-29s from the 393rd Bomb Squadron flying off of Tinian. Very few veterans from that squadron remain with us today, but one of them is 95 and going strong in Visalia, California. His name is Norris Jernigan, and we have the privilege of spending the next hour with him. We'll hear about the extreme secrecy that surrounded the project, some of the twists and turns that proved fateful, and how he feels it should all be remembered 75 years later. But as always, we like to start at the beginning. So Norris, where were you born and where'd you grow up?
Born in Eugene, Oregon, when I was three months shy of 3 years old. My mother suddenly died, and of course my dad had to work, and he had my brother and I that had to be taken care of. So he moved us to New Mexico to live with his parents so he could still work. So left Oregon probably just 3 years old when I left there, yeah.
So you never really knew your mother?
You know, I can swear I can have glimpses of just certain things. And one of the things, of course, that sticks in my head, it's a picture. You know, it's just embedded there. Somebody lifted me up to see her in the casket. I couldn't understand because I only had the one lid open, and I thought they had cut her legs off, you know, and I kept wanting to know where her legs were. I remember that and why, you know, unless it was such a shock to me or something. I don't know. It all happened very suddenly. My brother and I were with her when she collapsed. My dad was at work and saw her collapse and fall on the floor. And my brother took me. He was 2 years older than me. So he took me next door to see if he could get help. And the other picture I have is when this big, long car put her in it and hauled her away. And that must have been an ambulance. She never gain consciousness after that.
So here, some of your first memories are memory of a tragedy in your family.
Yeah, it's indelible, just printed there, and it just has stuck with me. A lot of people say it's impossible at that age that you would remember, but I disagree.
Well, I believe you. So what about your childhood? You guys end up in California?
Yes. My dad remarried when I was 7 years old, and he inherited a stepson. And it wasn't long until that marriage was going to produce a child. And so my dad felt it was time to take the blended family away from the other family there in New Mexico and move us to California. So we moved to California, and he bought a little 40-acre ranch south of Sacramento between Elk Grove and Galt out in the boondocks there. Yeah. Of course, the Great Depression was on then, so that little ranch saw us through the Depression.
Where'd you go to high school?
Galt High School. Went through 3 years there. The end of my junior year, I was approaching my 18th birthday and knew I'd have to register for the draft. I did not want to be drafted, so I wanted to enlist before I became 18, and of course my dad would have to sign for me to do that. Originally I wanted to join the Navy, but my dad was working at Mare Island Navy Yard at that time, and he said, absolutely not, I could never feel right about signing for you to join the Navy. He said, I'm pulling too many body parts out of those ships that are coming in for repair that I would ever feel good about letting you go in the Navy. But he said, your older brother's in the Army Air Corps. If you want to go that route, he said, I'll sign for you. So I said, sure. And at that point, I became very interested in flying, becoming a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So I enlisted in the Army Air Corps cadet program.
Before I forget, let's go back a couple years to December 7th, 1941.
Yes.
Because you're in high school at the time. I guess your brother was probably still in high school at the time, too.
Yes, he was.
What do you remember about that day and how you found out and how it affected you?
Yes. We had a small dairy as well, and my dad wanted to expand it a little bit, so he had purchased four more cows. And the only time that the people could deliver it would have been on Sunday, December 7th. So, okay, we all waited around all morning for them to show up. They didn't get there until shortly after lunchtime. And when they got out of the truck, the guy said, "Hey, did you hear about Pearl Harbor? The Japanese really struck it. They really bombed it." Well, that was the first we heard about it because we didn't have the radio on all morning. So we did not know. And when he said Pearl Harbor, I thought, I wonder where Pearl Harbor is. I didn't even know where it was. But anyhow, it was kind of a somber effect on us to think that, wow, looks like we're headed for war.
And had you had any friends in school that were of Japanese ancestry?
Oh, yes. Galt High School was made up of a large percentage of Japanese kids. And many of them are my friends. And then, of course, shortly after Pearl Harbor Day, I think it was early in 1942, President Roosevelt decreed that the Japanese should be gathered up and put in, you don't want to use the word concentration camps, it wasn't supposed to be, but that's about what it amounted to.
Yeah.
And hauled off. Well, it just completely devastated our football team because a football team was just reduced to nothing because of such a large percentage of Japanese kids that were in our high school.
And for you, as a teenager, to see all these kids that you've been around for years in school, and all of a sudden they're getting taken away and sent behind barbed wire, how did that strike you? Was it hard to wrap your brain around that?
Well, it was, yes. And yet immediately the nation had to overnight create a hatred for the Japanese people. So mixed emotions about it, you know. Some of them were my friends, and all of a sudden they're my enemies. So it was a very strange feeling, you know.
So you leave high school, you join the Army Air Corps, and you're in the cadet program.
Yes.
And how did that progress? When did that course take a turn?
Well, went into active duty and was sent to Shepherd Field, Texas for the Army basic training because back then the Air Force was part of the Army. It was a division of the Army. Took my basic training there and then went on to the next step of the cadet program. Was sent to Denver and enrolled in Denver University for a semester. And that's where we had our first flying lessons. It was some small private field near Denver. I think his name was Hayden Field, but I'm not really positive about that anymore. But had my 10 hours of flight instruction there. Then after the semester was ended, came time for our school squadron to be sent to a classification center to decide whether we qualified for further pilot training or whether we would go to navigator school or bombardier school or somewhere else. Well, when we got to, it was in Santa Ana, California. When we got there, we checked daily to see what the list looked like, where we would go. The pilot list, the bombardier list, and the navigator list wasn't growing very fast, but the somewhere else list was. One day there was my name on the somewhere else, and so that was the end of my cadet training. We wondered why, because about two-thirds of my school squadron was eliminated.
Wow.
The reason they gave us was that they were gaining a surplus of aviation students to go on to the next step. So, you know, in the military, you just can't have people sitting around doing nothing. So we were eliminated from the program to free up the backlog of people waiting for further training. They decided to send me to Amarillo, Texas, to go to airplane mechanic school. There again, the wisdom of the military decided... I was mechanically inclined, and about as mechanically inclined as a black cat, I guess you'd say. Anyhow, went down there, and we laid around there waiting for the next class to start up. And after about 4 or 5 weeks, they called us together and said that they had decided to close that school, and we would be sent to a redistribution center, which was in Salt Lake City. Set up there, and... was there about 2 weeks, I guess, while they were trying to decide where to send everybody. They were just funneling them through there and sending them out. And finally, they said, well, they're closing so many of the schools now. We're going to be sending you out to tactical groups that are training for overseas duty, and you'll be going out of here as an on-the-job trainee. So they sent me to Fairmont, Nebraska to become part of a B-29 group. Well, I'd never heard of a B-29, but... anyhow, we went to Fairmont, Nebraska, worked in the motor pool for a little while because they sent me out as a truck driver. There again, the wisdom of the Army.
They keep checking boxes you weren't willing to check for yourself, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, you have decisions made for you, which I wasn't used to. And anyhow, I was there just about a month, maybe. And as the number of people grew, they finally broke us into three different squadrons. And it was the 393rd Bomb Squadron, the 398th Bomb Squadron, and the 421st Bomb Squadron. I wound up in the 393rd Bomb Squadron. And one day, one of the guys that was in the administrative office, which we referred to as the orderly room, was going through the personnel records and noticed that I had been with the cadet program and I just had completed a semester at Denver University. Called me in and said, I see you were in the cadet program. What are you doing driving a truck? And I said, well, you don't argue. You do and go where you're told, and you do what you're told to do. We had three answers, yes, sir, no excuse, sir. Anyhow, he said, well, I'll tell you, there's an opening in the intelligence office here in the squadron if you're interested. It requires some typing. And I said, well, that's no problem. I took a semester of high school typing. So he said, well, if you're interested, go over and talk to him. So I did. I went over to the intelligence office, and they decided to give me a try. So I went into the intelligence office as an on-the-job trainee. And I was with the 393rd Bomb Squadron Intelligence Office for the rest of the time I was in the service.
And that would really change your life.
Yes. We started our training in the spring of 1944, and by the end of August, all of the squadrons, especially the 393rd, was complete with their training. They were ready to go overseas. All of a sudden, orders came through transferring the 393rd Bomb Squadron away from the 504th and sending us to Wendover Field, Utah. Well, never heard of Wendover Field because I'd never been there before, but anyhow, we got to Wendover, and what a cultural shock that was. Out there on the salt flats, away from everything, 120 miles west of Salt Lake City, the little town of Wendover was nothing. It was just a small casino, and then a small state line hotel was all that was there, really, and a few citizens.
And there was a reason they wanted you all in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly, and we found that out later. Well, about the second day we were there, the enlisted men, I understand the officers were pulled into the one of the theaters and briefed, and the enlisted men in our squadron, we were told to assemble out in front of the orderly room. This lieutenant colonel hopped up on the back of a truck so he could see everybody and said, all right, men, gather around, I want to talk to you. So he said, introduced himself, he says, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and I want you to know that you've been brought here for a purpose. You're going to become part of an organization that's going to be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. Now, it's top secret, high security. You're not to talk to anybody. You're not to tell anybody where you're stationed. You're not to talk to anybody about what you're doing. You're not supposed to talk to each other. So I want you now to all go on a two-week furlough. Go home, get rested up, come back, because we're going to go into an intense training program and get ready to go overseas. Well, of course, we were so excited to find out we were going to be something special. But he stressed again, remember, top secret, security is high, so don't tell anybody anything. So we left to go on a two-week leave, but what we didn't know, he wasn't concerned about us getting rested up. It was a test to see if anybody could keep their mouth shut. Some of the guys, when they got home, had telegrams waiting for them to report back to the base immediately. And they found out when they got back to the base, they had just casually mentioned something to somebody about where they were stationed or going to be involved in something special or whatever, whatever they talked about. There was one story that was circulated, and we never could find out whether it was true or not, but it certainly made an impression on us that they really meant business about this security. It seems that one of the guys that was going on leave, while he was waiting to get his bus, train, or airplane, wherever it was, decided to go in the bar and have a drink while he was waiting. So he's sitting at this bar, and a Catholic priest came in and sat down beside him. And, of course, he struck up a conversation. I see, my son, you're in the service. Yes. Where are you stationed? Oh, we're out at Wendover. Wendover? What in the world are you doing there? Well, we're not sure. It's some top-secret project we're going to be involved in. Aha! Yeah. Okay. So he went on home, and he had a telegram waiting for him. When he got back to the base, he was met by the so-called Catholic priest, who was in a business suit, was part of FBI security. We never knew who it was, and maybe it was nobody. Maybe it was just a story that was circulated to catch our attention, which it certainly did, because we realized that they meant business. You didn't know who you were talking to when you left that base.
Was it hard for you to keep that secret? Were there times you were tempted?
Oh, heavens, yes. But fortunately, I somehow or other kept it.
It's time for a break, but when we come back from Wendover, Utah, to the island of Tinian, where history was made 75 years ago this week, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with today's guest, Norris Jernigan, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.